With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello and welcome to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. As always, I'm your host, Anna Pajaisky, and this episode I talked to paint maker Ezra Alhamal about pigments. Ezra is a Saudi artist, podcaster and researcher based in London, and we started by talking about how Ezra's move to London has informed her artistic practice.
I've been in London for 7 years now, and my move to London actually has been quite impactful on the what I do, all of it, because I studied interior design from the beginning, but then in my master's I kind of started practicing Islamic art, and this is when a lot of things changed, and I was like, wow, there is this whole world of art and material and tradition that I haven't heard of before. Well, it's kind of like, you know, it growing up as an Arab, you're like, oh, there's this great art and mosques that we have, but it's like it didn't click until then that it's like a complete art form that has like so many different areas. And I was like, oh, I would love to learn more. And like I started with some basic geometry classes with Art of Islamic Pattern with Adam and Richard, and that led into doing more classes at the Prince's School of Traditional Arts. And I carried on with my master's, which is in interior architecture. And from there, I started my PhD. But then with the PhD, I was like, I really want a new, like a subject that's relevant to that field, but interesting enough that I will continue doing that for 4 years.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, it's like after 4 years, whatever you like becomes boring. Mm-hmm. Imagine eating cake for 4 years. I mean, that never gets old, but if it was the same exact flavor.
So true.
So I chose to research biomorphic pattern, which is kind of the natural looking. Some people call it arabesque and stuff like that. And that took me on kind of a journey that I'm still on, and it completely changed my path. And I consider myself an artist now because that's what I would love to continue doing. And it feels great. When I was studying design, it was nice, but I didn't really feel super connected to it. It was like, oh, okay, I'm good at this, I'll continue doing this. But then when I started doing the art part, then I was like, oh, this is what it means when you're really enjoying something.
Amazing.
So here we are.
I'd love to hear more about Islamic art, because it's something that I'm not sure all listeners will be familiar with. You mentioned geometry as well. How is geometry, why is geometry kind of related to Islamic art?
So with Islamic art, it's like a really big umbrella term. So when people say it, sometimes it's like everything under the sun, from the beginning of Islam, which started in the 7th century of life. Was it 7th century? Maybe 8th century. Sometimes it's like between the English one and the Arabic one. I get super confused. But basically, it started from the beginning of Islam, and then it kind of expanded all until the 18th century. So it's like, how are we meant to put all of that under one term called Islamic art? And not to mention the geographical location changes. So the Islamic world is really big. It's not just Saudi. It's like all the area around the Arab world that people refer to as the Middle East and North Africa. And then you get like parts of Asia within that and parts of Europe. And it seems to be like everything that happened during all that time and all that vast geography is called Islamic art. But in reality, Islamic art is kind of divided into subsections. And one of the main ones is geometry. So a lot of the patterns are based on geometry. They are based on mathematics. They all make sense. And sometimes, like some writers, like especially end of 19th century, like to say that, oh, Muslims just did geometry because they were not supposed to do figurative art. It's not true. And just geometry is not even fair, because geometry is really hard. And it's so beautiful as well. And it's like, it has, doing geometry, it like can enable you to do so many different things as well. And having the mind to do those extremely complex patterns is really mind-blowing.
So when you say geometry, is this to do with sort of symmetry and repeated patterns?
Yeah, so basically you, with Islamic geometry or any geometry, the beginning is the same. You take a compass and a straight edge and you start from the circle, then do different divisions depending on what you want. One of the very popular divisions is eightfold stars. And like you see it, you also see sixfold stars as well within the Islamic patterns, like so many. You get into like fives and tens and it gets so complicated. And from that, you can build so many patterns. My specialty is not within the basic geometry. It's like, I know just the basics. And from that, I can analyze the biomorphic patterns, because biomorphic patterns tend to be less complicated geometrically at the beginning, because the geometry is usually hidden and you'll see like the freehand flowing shapes that are inspired from nature. So you don't need it to be super complicated because you have like all this beauty on top of it. But when it's just pure geometry, it becomes like another level. It's like fivefold and tenfold. They are kind of where I would love to head, but it's still, I'm still at the beginning. Like my friend Samira Mann, she is the one who is specialized in Islamic geometry, and all like the two guys that I mentioned at the beginning.
So this is a materials podcast, and we're going to be talking about the materials that you use to make your beautiful artwork. Can you take us through kind of the materials that you use?
Of course. So part of the art that I do is Islamic illumination. And with illumination is the use of the gold. This is where the word comes from. And my first thing that fascinated me about this specific type was the gold. And I was like, oh my God, you're serious? We are going to take genuine 24 karat gold and putting in our painting. And that's it. I think that was the moment I knew this art is for me, because
nice.
Expensive taste all around. And it just like, it was so fascinating working with real gold, because we're like in Saudi or in the Middle East, we're used to wearing gold. It's, I mean, not because we're super rich, just because it is the kind of accessory, well, yeah, I guess accessory that you would wear. You didn't like be covered in gold top to like head to toe, but you would kind of have like a few pieces. You'd have like gold earrings that you got as a child, or like a necklace or whatever. So it's like, I am familiar with the higher carats of gold, because it's like, that's the type of gold they make. But then to take that and paint with it, like when I started, my sister was like, can you make me a necklace? I was like, no, it's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
I'm not making jewelry. It's just gold on paper. And it's just making that gold from leaf into paint. And then using, because if we're using gold on paper, you want to use something that's equally precious or like important to kind of pair it with, because otherwise it's quite a shame to just use plastic next to gold.
Right.
So this is when I learned about natural pigments and how to make paints from natural materials and sources and bring it in, like to pair it with the gold and have it on top of, well, next to the painting to cover the whole pattern. But I wasn't like, it was kind of, because making gold and making paints from pigments, they're not the easiest things. But they're not the hardest things either. You just have to be like into it to actually be like, okay, I justify spending 1 hour for one color. So with the gold, it actually takes, well, once you make quite a good amount, it can sustain you for a while, depending on how much you paint with it. So with the gold, it will take me about 2 to 3 hours of preparation at the beginning. And that's basically taking the gold leaf from the booklet one by one, crushing it with like using two fingers or the side of your hand on a plate and using honey or gum arabic and just making it the finest that could possibly be. And you would wash it for like about kind of for like three times, and that takes like 2 to 3 days. So it takes a while for the gold, but again, once you have enough, like when I do a booklet, it's usually enough for like three A3 paintings.
Okay.
So it is quite enough, but making paints from pigments is quite a different process, because you do have like a little mulling aspect, like when you are mixing everything, like the pigment and the binder, and that takes about an hour for each color, depending on how coarse, how fine it is. Like you can finish it quicker, and it also depends on which one. So like paint, like pigments that come from the earth, just like ochres that are on the ground, like clays, they are quite good because they're super soft. So even as a rock form, you can crush it quite quicker, you can make it into the fine powder and then make it into the paint without having like too many issues. It's like, it's straightforward, it's great. And ochres are the oldest form of paints that we've used, and they track them to using paint on body. So there's a brilliant book called Color by, I think, Victoria Finlay, but maybe like look that up.
Sure.
And oh my God, it's so good because it tells you everything about the beginning of color and how precious ochres were to put in rituals and on the body and in like cave paintings. It's really fascinating. But earths are really easy, but well, to an extent they are. And then you come to minerals, which is like a completely different experience. So if I'm working on, say, the lapis lazuli, is it really different than working with the earth? Like it takes longer. I usually don't take it from rock form because the mineral itself is really tough. So it takes a while for you to like be able to crush it. There is a Lebanese artist who's based in London called Jumana Medlej. She wrote a book at the beginning of the year talking about all these materials and how you do them. And she has like some clever tricks for dealing with lapis lazuli, which is really helpful, like adding vinegar, heating it up, and you're like, aha,
nice.
These are great tips. And she took them from like various historic sources. So it's like kind of continuing with the tradition. And it just, sometimes you get softer minerals like malachite, which is nice and soft, so the rock is easily crushable and then you can mull it easier. But then you kind of deal with it in a different way because the pigment is kind of sensitive, and if you overwork it, it becomes like, it will give you a hint of gray. Sometimes it becomes fluorescent depending on like how good is your rock. And sometimes people think, oh, the best rocks should be for jewelry, but what you use for pigments should be jewelry grade rocks that you're gonna crush into making paint. So it's a fascinating world of possibilities, because sometimes you are limited as well with nature. You don't have really bright colors, so you don't have that super yellow. It's like when I say yellow, like a bright banana yellow, you don't really get that in nature. So you have like a muted yellow tone, and sometimes our brains are not used to that. It's like, what do you mean I can't use this color? Like I want to use purple, but right. I'm sorry, you can't. Like, purple is a really hard one to get, and it's like really limited. And maybe yes, you can mix lapis with maybe carmine to get a purple, but then it's like you can't make, oh, kind of like my heart aches if I ever mix lapis, because it's so precious. I want to use it as its like purest form, and it looks beautiful next to gold.
Amazing. This really sounds like a labor of love, from like getting hold of the materials and then spending days and days crushing them and mixing them and stuff. Yeah, very impressive.
There are ways to like make it quicker as well. So it's like if you so because I started paint making for others, and this is when you learn shortcuts.
Okay.
Because it's like I can't just sit there in my table and do this for days upon days.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can, but you can like speed up the process by maybe getting powdered pigments rather than crushing it from rocks, getting all your binder ready, knowing the exact recipe, which changes, by the way, from each color. Like, even though like I use different ochres, so I have yellow, red, brown, green, all from the earth, which is beautiful. Like, I didn't realize we ever had green sand. I mean, it's not, I don't think I ever saw a sand, but it was like clay formations somewhere. I've never seen it in person, but I got some a hold of some green earth, which is like so beautiful. But then the recipe for it really changes than making red ochres or yellow ochres. So it's quite interesting, because each color has its own personality and ways of making.
Amazing. Are there any sort of traditional significances for different colours? Like, are certain colours associated with different concepts, I guess, in Islam?
It's a really difficult to answer the spirituality and the symbolism of things, because as individuals, we like to think that things are really precious in a spiritual way, and like, oh, that just a connection to heaven and stuff, which maybe it was at some point, but nothing is 100% proven. And in Quranic text, like the Islamic text in Quran, the only color mentioned as a color is to describe something is green.
Okay.
So a lot of people use green as the color of Islam just because they're like, oh, but it's mentioned in the Quran. So
right.
It's like some garments of people who are going to wear in heaven are made of some green material. So you're like, okay, cool. And I think vegetation, because it's green, so we always feel like connected to that.
Mm.
Blue is mentioned in somewhat. So blue has been used so much within Islamic tiles and Islamic manuscripts, but you don't know if it's like a sign of like a symbolism sign, or if it was actually because blue was precious and it's a sign of power and wealth. So
right.
There are things that are like, how sure are you?
Which came first? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because they did use these materials as a proof of their wealth. Like, especially those leaders, they wanted to prove a point with these colors, with these patterns, with the grand buildings. Like when the Timurids came in the 14th century, they made it a point to do the building so grand that it's like miles for you to stand. So it's just, it's really interesting to kind of track what happened and how things came about.
Yeah, amazing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra.
Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Do you have to stay true to the Islamic region, or do you get materials from North America, Australia, South America? Like, how closely do you stay to kind of traditional materials that would have been available to Islamic artists?
Some of it is very within the Islamic region, but within the Islamic region, again, it's like a really vast geography. So lapis lazuli only came from Afghanistan at the beginning. Now it's like there are different sources for it in South America that people are using. Mm-hmm. But even in with Italian artists, they were using that Afghani lapis that came all the way, and they referred to it as ultramarine because it's like it's from beyond the sea.
Like
a very specific thing. So like the Italian artist palette, I think, is very close to what I would use because it's a mix of Europe and mixed of the Muslim world. And Muslim world was really well connected, so they had ties in Europe, but they didn't use a lot of European ochres. So like this green earth, for example, that I just mentioned, I haven't really seen it. Maybe it's there, but they used expensive minerals with a lot of the Islamic work, more than just like cheaper ochres. So they used lapis lazuli that was there. What else did they use? They used a lot of malachite, and malachite, you can see formations of it like across like lots of places. Recently I like read that they are bringing it from Algeria, and I was like, that is so cool. I'll just buy the specific one just to kind of feel connected to that part of the world.
Cool.
But then they used a lot of Asian, popular Asian pigments. So it's like, you know that the cinnabar, the Chinese red, they used it a lot. And it had like mercury in it. And then they had vermilion. They've used they were limited in resources there and like in the Muslim world by what's around them, but they still got around. But I would say my palette is a mix of things. So I use a lot of Italian and French earth in my work, and just like with the ones I make, also because I want to be sustainable to the geographical region where I am. So I'm trying to kind of resource from the closest environment to me.
Okay, cool. So are there any, do you get like British pigments then?
Yeah, actually there are some. So chalk is a great British one. We have like mountains of that. You get a lot of yellow ochres as well. So it's like we were visiting Hastings at the beginning of the year before lockdown, mm-hmm. the last actual trip that we had, who knew? And we like just, there was like this really nice river that connects to the ocean. I don't know if it was like a proper river. It was a stream somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like we saw it in the nature reserve, and by the riverbanks, or like just next to the water streams, there was like these really small yellow rocks. And I collected a few, just like tiny ones. And I was like, oh, I'm going to make some yellow paints from that. They're still there. I did crush some. I haven't like painted with it. And there are some people on Instagram. There was a girl called London Pigment. And she literally gets pigments just from London. And she collects it from around the River Thames. And there's like some red bricks that are coming from just the buildings that washes off. There's like some oranges and some yellows. It's a very limited palette, so you're not finding like, I don't know, mineral that is very precious. But you're still getting like some really nice colors. You get slate gray as well, which is like quite good if like you can get that. So yeah, there are a few things that you can make just from even just from London.
That's really cool. Are there any interesting sort of either traditional or like maybe chemical even relationships? Like, would you ever not put two pigments together because you know they're going to chemically react in some way? Or are there any kind of more traditionally paired colors to others?
Well, I haven't like super experimented with chemical reactions, but it seemed from like, I don't even know if there would be some chemical reactions from pairings of colors, but so far they seem to be all right.
That's good.
I don't have explosions making them, so that's really good. But there is a particular pigment that I make, and I'm not sure how long I'll keep making it. It's a very traditional one called verdigris, and it's basically copper and vinegar. It's just like copper soaked in vinegar until it becomes this beautiful, bright turquoise. It's like, imagine the color of a tropical ocean. This is how it looks. It's
amazing.
So pretty. But then eventually it's going to burn your paper.
Oh,
so
wow.
It really depends how bad do you want this color and how long do you want your painting to last. So it's like in Quranic manuscripts, in some of the Abbasid manuscripts from the 9th century and the 10th century, you have like some just like mini brown burn marks. And this is where the verdigris used to be.
Wow.
And I had a chat with Christine Rose Bears. So I was having a chat with her, and she was saying that all the pigments that are copper containing, they will eventually affect your paper in some way or another.
Oh, really?
And it's like, it's a new world when you speak to like book conservators. You're like, what? Tell me more. I didn't even know this. This is why I'm like, I'm warning my customers about it. I'm like, well, this, it could happen, but sometimes it's just, it's a really pretty color. And you're like, how long do I want this to last? Like, maybe I just want it to last for 10 years, maybe just 20 years, and it's fine.
Yeah, maybe you can incorporate that into the design as well.
Exactly. Be like, this area might burn at some stage, so like, make it, I don't know, creative. It's like using silver, for example, within your painting. So silver tarnishes and it becomes black. So sometimes when you look at a historic painting and the river is black, it used to be silver.
Right.
So, which is something I didn't know until I started like researching this. And I was like, oh, interesting. But then it's like, there's a beauty to this, having that tarnished effect. On your paper, you're like, it lived through all of this, that now it changed. So it tells you the age. So that's in terms of like chemical reactions in a way,
sure,
but with history. But in terms of classical pairings, gold and lapis lazuli are the best.
Okay.
You always see them together. You also sometimes get some malachite and cinnabar. They are really beautiful together. There are like lots of little classical ones that you can get from manuscripts. You're like, you look at what they've done and you're like, oh, I see you've done it in a few different ones. It really works. I'm going to do the same.
What are you looking into next? Like, what are the unanswered questions in your work that you'd like to find out about?
I think I want to do more mixes of colors.
Okay.
To maybe do more, I don't know, more greens, more blues, more purples, because they're really difficult to just find in a raw organic form. So So it will be nice to kind of find specific mixtures that would be like, okay, this is how I make my purples. This is how I'm going to make all my greens. Because now my greens, actually greens are not too, too bad, because I thought they were bad, but they're not as bad as blue. So with green, I have green earth, I have malachite, there is some cylindite. What was the other one? And there's opal. Opal is kind of a new green that I've been experimenting with. Jade green is very disappointing. Basically, if you crush jade, it becomes gray.
Oh, really? So, that's interesting.
it's a very gray color. Although some artists were like, oh, this is so nice. It has like a very light green hint. I mean, you have to kind of have like extra vision to see that green hint. But it's like you get some natural sources, but where it's like the blue naturally, there is lapis lazuli, there's azurite, but the azurite blue has a hint of green because it's the same rock that brings malachite as well. So I would love to learn more about these mixtures and like how to bring more of them to the surface. Probably purple would be kind of my next adventure.
Nice.
Because it's a really nice color. It's like you don't really see much of it maybe you do see some of it in nature sometimes when you get like a purple sky, but then you don't have that in actual color, and like in pigment form. And I'm like, oh, I want to reach that. So okay.
So sometimes, sometimes you start from the color and try and work back and find the substance that you want to make the pigment out of.
For sure. Yeah.
That's so cool. Just going back to talk about techniques again quickly. You mentioned the kind of the crushing and grinding process to make the pigments into powders. What do you then have to mix them with before they can really be applied as paints?
So this is when it comes to how you want your paint to become. So are you watercolor artist? Do you want this to be watercolor? Do you want it to be gouache, or do you want it to be oils? I personally use watercolors, and I use them in a very opaque way. So when you look at manufactured gouache from just like some that you buy from the store, they add fillers. So basically it's watercolor plus a filler, but I don't add that filler. I just use the pure pigment in a very opaque way. And that kind of gives me the license to use to make it into watercolor or to make to like modern day gouache, but it is reality, just opaque watercolor. So for that, I use gum arabic as my binder. If you want to stay true to like just the area where you're from, you can get gum from cherry trees as well, but it's not as strong. So it depends where you want the gum to come from. Arabian gum, which is actually coming from Senegal and Nigeria. So it's kind of like African gum, to be honest, but this is what it's known for, as the Arabian gum. Anyway, I'm not going to analyze the name. I get sometimes caught up of like, oh, let me get this source. Why did they call this? Anyway, so for the binder, I would use gum arabic. I use it all the time, and I use natural preservatives within that. You use a wetting agent. You can get natural ones, chemical ones, whatever you like. And that's how you would make that. If you are interested in making your own oils, which is very possible, some pigments you'd have to read up on how some pigments react. So not every single pigment you can pair it with oil, but a lot of them do work fine with oils. And then this is like a whole different game with like oil colors.
So you mentioned earlier about your customers and that you're now kind of making this a bit more of a business. Can you tell me a bit about how that came about?
Of course. So in July, I decided this is it. This is the month in the middle of lockdown, because what other activity would you rather do than just make paint for you and for everyone else? So in July, I was like, this is going to happen, and it's going to be a brand, and I'm not going to dwell on it, and I'm just going to make it happen.
Brilliant.
Because sometimes we get so lost and like, oh, what do I call it? How am I doing this? I was like, nope, I'm sitting down, putting everything on paper and just making it happen.
Brilliant.
So literally that's what it was. Like, I have a monthly newsletter on my Islamic Illumination page. So I like to announce things the first Friday of every month. So that was kind of my deadline. I was like, I have a week till Friday, and I've been buying pigments and collecting recipes and comparing things since the end of last year. So around November, I was like, oh, I would like to make this into business, but I don't have time at the moment. So basically, I just bought every possible thing that you could buy. And I was like, I kept collecting them slowly. I was like, okay, so I need this and I need that. And then this is when I was like, okay, I haven't done this. Why am I not doing this? So we sat one evening, my partner and I, and I was like, we need to come up with a name. And we just like jotted down all these different names until I think mostly he came up with the name. I don't know if I'm giving him full credit for the name. I think we both kind of did it together.
Yeah, let's say that. We'll go with that version of events.
Yeah, exactly. And we called it Bristle and Brush. So, and it's funny. Now people ask me, oh, do you sell brushes as well? I'm like, damn. I didn't obviously think it through because like we made a decision within that hour, and I was like, oh, I just need a name right now. I'm gonna order labels.
Names are so hard as well. You can spend, I know this, I've tried to name various projects and it's taken me years to come up with decent names.
You need a good name because it feels like this is kind of your baby and you want it, like you want to present it to the world. So then we came up with Bristle and Brush and started kind of small. Like the first month in July, we did the Earth collection, just like a small six color palette, which, as I mentioned, it has the six colors all from French and Italian grounds. And then kind of the next month, we graduated into like adding the ocean palette. The ocean palette is a bit of a question mark just because it includes all the difficult minerals. So it didn't make an appearance after that. It might come on later. And then now I'm trying to kind of get into a specific range that I bring in every month. So I added two, which is the modern illumination, just because I do illumination. I just needed a set for illumination as well. And it's quite cool because it includes different paints that are also chemically made. So they're not all natural, just because certain colors, like if people can't afford genuine gold, I didn't want them not to have that joy of sparkle.
Oh.
So I did like imitation gold, like gold luster. And then it comes with smalt, which is paint that was manufactured in the 16th century. And then I added hematite because it's just so cool. It's like a volcanic mineral. It's really fascinating. And and then black and white, because you just need them to make the variations with illumination work. And then I did the wonder set, which is 12 colors, because everybody was like, oh, but this is six colors are not enough. And I was like, well, your wish is my command. So I did the 12 colors, but again, I make them in very small batches every month because, as I said, every color takes a few hours of work. So it takes me 4 hours to make one color. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of made it limited so far into like 15 colors, which I still think it's like a huge amount. So I was like, oh my God, I'm working all these hours of the day. But it's been really nice because a lot of people haven't tried these materials, and Bristle and Brush gave them the opportunity to try them for themselves. So somebody was like, I've never dreamed of like using lapis and malachite. And it's amazing to share it with others. Like when I started learning about pigments, I was like, oh my God, what a faff. I'm not even going to make it for myself. And now making it for myself and making it for other people. And you're like, okay, fine. I admit this is rewarding and nice. I like it.
That's great. And are these paints that anyone can pick up and use?
Yeah, all you need is just add some water to it and just mix it well and paint with it. And I try and warn people on certain ones. So like verdigris, I told people about the effects that it might have. With lapis, I tell them like to mix it with other color, just because it's a really precious blue. It's a gem that comes only from like three places in the world, and you're like, you can't waste this, be super careful. So I mean, you price it accordingly, so people will kind of No, it's a different thing from just buying something from the store.
Sure.
You're like, you're kind of, your heart is in it as well. And you're like, please be careful, use it. But then you see what people paint with things and you're like, oh, that's so pretty. They use the things I made to make this beauty. And it's just, it's a kind of a well-rounded experience, I feel.
Yeah, that must be a great feeling. It. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So if people have enjoyed hearing from you and hearing about Islamic art and the pigments that you make, where do you recommend that they can go to see some examples and to find out more?
So I have my Instagram page, Islamic Illumination, and then my website, islamicillumination.com. And if you are interested in learning more about it, I have a few blog posts and some book recommendations, which I think is so important to read. So if you are intrigued about a subject, check out the book list on the resource page to kind of give you an idea of all of that. And for the paints, you can find me on bristleandbrush.uk or at bristleandbrushart. Yeah, because Instagram has already been taken and you're like, oh.
Oh, that's annoying.
Yeah, it's okay. Now it's art. Bristle and brush art. So it's fine.
Fair enough. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really great to chat to you.
Thank you for having me.
So that was the fantastic Ezra Alhamal. Thanks so much to her for taking the time to come on the podcast and talk about all things pigments. That's everything for this time. As always, I'd be really grateful if you could like and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to make a one-time donation to support the pod financially, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. If there's any material that you'd like to hear covered or making practice that you'd like to learn about, then do get in touch. We're at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, on Twitter and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. Thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for the cover art and to Alex Lethbridge for the music mix. Next week, I'll be joined by Objects Conservator Chloe Rumsey to talk about adhesives. So until then, I hope you have a great week and I'll see you next time on Handmade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.